Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 6th of December, these are our main stories.
The bombings didn't stop. We're now heading to Rafah, to the unknown, and I don't know if I'll make it anymore.
People in Gaza flee the southern city of Khan Yunis, which has been surrounded by Israeli forces on the heaviest day of fighting since their invasion of the territory. Washington says it'll refuse visas for extremist Israeli settlers who've attacked Palestinians. Also,
my boys, their school friends, their parents, when you say we are separated because I don't earn enough, they look at you as though it's incredulous. They're like, what do you mean? But you're married. Yes. And he's their father. Yeah.
The families torn apart by the UK's latest plans to cut back on immigration. Also in this podcast, we hear about the mass exodus of Sri Lanka's medical staff to other countries and
a football fan told us that, well, this is taking all the fun out of the sport because it seems that the referee was actually helping Arkadak to win.
The Turkmenistan football team that just can't stop winning. An Israeli commander says his forces have been engaged in their most intense day of fighting since launching their offensive in the Gaza Strip. After days of fierce bombardment, Major General Yaron Finkelman said his troops were in the heart of the city of Khan Yunis in the south of the territory. Civilians there have been urged to flee as Israel targets what it says are Hamas strongholds. Dima Ghanem, a 22-year-old student, sent this WhatsApp message to the BBC.
After moving to Khan Yunis from Gaza City, we thought it would be safe here. We were so wrong. Last night was insane. The bombings didn't stop even for a single minute. The situation here is even more chaotic. We don't know how to save our lives anymore or a way to go. People are just furious and scared, and we're all trapped when bombings are nonstop. People who are leaving to they're leaving to build tents in the streets in this cold weather, and there's no enough food or resources in Rafah for an extra 1 million people. We're now heading to Rafah, to the unknown, and I don't know if I'll make it anymore.
In the north of Gaza, Israeli troops have surrounded the Jabalia refugee camp, which they say is a base for Hamas militants. Speaking to the BBC, a spokesperson for the campaign group Human Rights Watch, Sari Bashi, said Israel had put Gazans in an impossible situation.
When you warn people to leave and there's no safe place to go to and no safe way to get there, that's not an effective warning. And under all circumstances, civilians who remain behind, either because they cannot or will not leave, retain their civilian protection. Giving people a QR code on social media when you've cut telecommunications, there's no electricity, and the maps themselves are confusing and error-ridden is a cruel joke.
Speaking from Ramallah in the West Bank, Mustafa Barghouti from the Palestinian National Initiative, a Palestinian political party, gave his assessment of the situation in Gaza.
Unfortunately, I have to tell you that what we see here is that Israel is violating so many international laws, conducting three war crimes at the same time. The war crime of genocide, the war crime of collective punishment, and the war crime of ethnic cleansing.
The former Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Olmert, says the Israeli government needs to make it clear what it thinks should happen next. Otherwise, they won't be given the time to complete the military operation. We'll be hearing from an Israeli MP shortly. But first, this report from our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams, who's in Jerusalem.
As Israeli forces turn their attention to the south, another city finds itself in the eye of the storm. This was Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis this morning. 4 days after the ceasefire ended, Israeli forces are gradually encircling the city. At the hospital, there's a desperate, constant procession of death, injury and grief. Lifting one small, shrouded body from the back of a pickup truck, Qasem Shiba faces the camera and demands, why did this child deserve to die? What did he do? 7 members of Qasem's family were killed as they slept. Death and displacement, 2 things Israel's American allies have asked it to minimize. But people are fleeing again, following Israel's instructions, never quite knowing if they're heading for safety or more danger. Further north in Deir al-Bala, a miraculous escape. 2 sisters, Maria and Lana, pulled alive from the rubble 3 days after being buried, along with dozens of members of their family.
I saw a body on the ground. At first, I thought it was my sister Katya. But then I looked again and I thought it's Jenna, my cousin.
Israel knows that this stage of its war against Hamas, conducted in areas ever more crowded and desperate, will be extremely challenging. Peter Lerner is a spokesman for the military.
Yes, there is a dire situation in the south where people are in stress, and we acknowledge that. We are constantly weighing up the military necessity of target against the humanitarian and civilian strife and concerns it will cause.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been meeting newly released hostages and the families of those still being held in Gaza. It was an angry encounter, with many wondering why the government couldn't bring more hostages home. Mr. Netanyahu replied that this had been simply impossible.
Paul Adams in Jerusalem. Yuli Edelstein is a member of the Knesset for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party. He's also a former health minister and currently chairs the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defence Committee. He told Rebecca Kesby that Israel is doing as much as possible to protect Gaza's civilian population.
It's our best interest, both for moral reasons, we're not after civilian population in Gaza, we're after Hamas there, but also for practical reasons, because Hamas understands very well that their only way out of the situation is to cause civilian casualties. And that's exactly what Hamas is trying to do. We are trying to avoid it in every possible way. Yes, unfortunately, I will tend to agree that there is a lot of chaos in Gaza, and we are doing practical things, using all the possible means of communication to inform the population where it is safe. It's not easy. It's a war, and we have to understand that Hamas started this with terrible atrocities. We'll try to avoid casualties among civilian population as much as we can.
But Israel is getting a lot of international criticism over those numbers of civilian dead. I mean, are you not worried that this assault on the people of Gaza will actually prompt more people to be radicalized against Israel? I mean, isn't that a danger?
This is Israel's, as I've said, both moral obligation and best interest to avoid civil casualties for the reasons that you mentioned. We don't want international pressure. We don't want to be perceived as a country that is taking revenge on someone. We are not in the revenge business. We are trying to make sure that the residents of peaceful Jewish communities in the south of the country that went through a terrible massacre on October 7.
May I put one theory to you that is actually getting a lot of traction among Palestinian communities, and that is that some Palestinians have the suspicion that Israel is trying to push people out of Gaza. Is that what you want?
The answer is no. And to my Palestinian neighbors, I would give one advice. We have to recognize an interesting fact. We are not going anywhere and they are not going anywhere. We'll have to learn live side by side. It's difficult to say this after what we witnessed on October 7. The moment the Palestinians will realize that they won't be able to see the destruction of the Jewish state and the expulsion of Jews from this area, I think that there will be a possibility to really have a dialogue and talk about future solutions. It's still probably not around the corner, but as I've said, I think that eventually they'll have to recognize the fact that Israelis and Palestinians are here to stay.
Yuli Edelstein speaking to Rebecca Kesby. In our previous podcast, we reported on Britain and Rwanda agreeing a new treaty aimed at getting the British government's flagship asylum policy operational following a series of legal challenges. The controversial plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda was deemed illegal last month by the UK's Supreme Court because people could be returned to their home countries, among other issues. Under this new treaty, that won't happen anymore, but some legal experts are still unhappy. Here's one of Britain's top lawyers, Geoffrey Robertson.
There were about a dozen reasons why Rwanda was an unsafe country. And it's going to deal via this treaty with only one of them.
I asked our UK political correspondent, Rob Watson, if the government will now be able to send asylum seekers from Britain to Rwanda.
It's absolutely not a slam dunk. Any asylum seeker who is earmarked for being sent to Rwanda will no doubt do their best to appeal and sort of contest this idea that the British government can't just declare somewhere safe through a treaty or passing a law.
And will this law get through Parliament quickly, as the government is suggesting?
You know, it depends on exactly how the law is framed. I mean, if the law is too hardline, some people on the more liberal wing of the governing Conservative Party won't like it. If the law isn't hardline enough, well, Mr. Sunak, the Prime Minister, will have a problem with the right wing of his party, so it could well be a bumpy ride.
And Rob, there are other changes to be made later this week involving appealing asylum decisions, aren't there?
There are, but I mean, the main issue is the attempt by the British government in legislation that's to come that will essentially just try to make it as hard as humanly possible for any decisions to be challenged in the UK courts. If you like, a sort of disavowal of human rights law when it comes to the specific issue of sending people to Rwanda. But of course, you know, you can bet your bottom dollar, Val, this of course is going to be challenged by lawyers, and it will be challenged by organisations and of course by those earmarked for travel.
Rob Watson. Well, this week the UK government also unveiled plans which it says will slash migration levels and curb abuse of the immigration system, delivering the biggest ever reduction in net migration. At the moment, if a UK citizen marries someone who isn't British, their spouse can reside with them here in the UK as long as the UK citizen earns $33,000, or just over £26,000 a year. From next March, that figure will increase to almost $50,000 a year, or almost £39,000. That's more than what three quarters of the population takes home. Raquel Roberts dos Santos has been married to a Brazilian man for 8 years. They have two young sons, as well as his 15-year-old daughter from a previous relationship. The family are split because he isn't allowed to live here in the UK. Raquel Roberts dos Santos spoke to Sarah Montague about why this latest announcement is so heartbreaking.
I gained a job which was the equivalent of £31,000 per annum salary.
Oh, my goodness. So what, you're now at a level where if you'd carried on, you could have proved you had this wage and your husband could have joined you, but the goalposts just moved.
Correct. They've taken the ground from underneath my feet. They've destroyed my hope.
How can you sustain a marriage over that distance?
We communicate daily. It is usually in the evening. There is a four-hour time difference, which obviously can complicate things. We share every bit of news through FaceTime, through all the channels of communication available now. We continue this long-distance relationship, and we will make it to be a family together again. And that's what we all want.
Have you thought about moving to Brazil?
I thought our boys would have a better future in England. I had had a gun put to my head and my car stolen at gunpoint in Brazil. I had been robbed breastfeeding in Brazil. I nearly lost both boys in a public hospital in Brazil. And it was almost the time to think about school. So I decided that it was better that we lived here and that we would take the 6 month separation and I would earn the money and we would see each other in 6 months. And that's now 4 years, 3 months.
How do you feel about it? Because obviously the centre of this is two people who clearly love each other very much.
Yes, we are absolutely resolute that no one or nothing can come between us and our family. And we will overcome this and we will be together. The news from yesterday is so distressful. It's left me distraught. The school run was so hard this morning when you see all those families, you know, mums and dads walking their kids to school, something so normal that people take for granted. there are thousands and thousands of families. We're all in the same boat. Even, you know, my boys, their school friends, their parents. When you say we are separated because I don't earn enough, they look at you as though it's incredulous. They're like, what do you mean? But you're married. Yes. And he's their father. Yes. The repercussions of these rules. It's not human to do this to people. What they have done yesterday will also impact the UK population. Basically, they've been told you cannot fall in love with a foreigner.
Raquel Roberts dos Santos speaking there to Sarah Montague. Sri Lanka's doctors, nurses and health technicians are leaving the country in their droves, putting pressure on the healthcare system. Now, operations at a regional hospital have been halted after the only surgeon in the area left Sri Lanka. It comes after the country defaulted on its foreign debt last year amid the worst financial crisis in years. I asked our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etharajan why so many doctors are emigrating.
You would be surprised to know that Sri Lanka has one of the best healthcare systems in South Asia. The hospitals are good, very clean. It used to be among the top in South Asia, but the economic crisis changed everything. Because the government was restricting the import of many items and also the prices went up, many hospitals ran out of essential medicines. Though the government managed to improve the situation, allowed more imports, the real problem is about what kind of salary you can give to these doctors. People are seeing that we don't have a future in Sri Lanka. If you're a doctor, it is easy for you to get a job overseas. According to the government, in the last about 18 months, more than 1,200 doctors, a quarter of them are specialists. These people, having attained their specialization, they're now leaving because they want either to go for higher studies and find a job or getting a job elsewhere. So this is causing a huge concern for the authorities. And this is having an impact on one of the hospitals. It is a key hospital in the eastern part of Sri Lanka. And without a surgeon, they're doing minor surgeries, but not the big ones, what a surgeon would do.
So how bad is the pay? Because the obvious question is, why don't they just pay doctors and nurses and other medical staff more?
The unions, the health officials and health unions have been negotiating with the government because if you look at the inflation rate, what happened? Prices of food items like cooking gas cylinders have doubled in the last few years, have even tripled. Electricity prices have gone up. But the salaries are not matching with what they were getting. Number two, if you're going to give it to health sector, what happens to the other government departments? Though they are going to demand the same kind of salary. So you are giving it to the health authorities. Why not to us? So the government is also under severe economic stress, even though they are increasing pay, but not to the level of what is on the ground in terms of inflation.
Anbarasan Etharajan. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
For sure, I do end up playing a lot of these kinds of not terribly likable, unlikable people.
I can't fail this class.
Oh, don't sell yourself short, Mr. Coates. I truly believe that you can.
The multi-award-winning actor Paul Giamatti on his new film, The Holdovers, which is being tipped for an Oscar. Let's return now to our main story, the situation in Gaza. The US is now saying it will revoke existing visas and future applications from hardline Israeli settlers who've carried out attacks against Palestinians in the West Bank. Washington also called on Palestinian officials to do more to curb Palestinian attacks on Israelis. The State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller announced the new measures.
Today, the United States is taking action to address this escalating violence in the West Bank by implementing a new visa restriction policy. Under this policy, the United States will pursue visa restrictions against individuals involved in or meaningfully contributing to the undermining of peace, security, or stability in the West Bank. This includes acts of violence against persons or property, as well as undue restrictions on civilians' access to essential services and basic necessities.
With more details, here's our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher.
The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the Biden administration had made clear to the Israeli government the need to do more to hold accountable extremist settlers who commit violent acts against Palestinians. The move to bar entry to the US to such individuals and possibly even their families sends a rare signal from Washington to Israel that its patience has been exhausted with the behaviour of some Israelis towards Palestinians. This year has seen several violent rampages by settlers against Palestinian towns in the West Bank, triggered by specific deadly attacks by Palestinian gunmen on Israelis, but bringing to the surface tensions that have been seething for decades as settlements have spread across the West Bank.
Sebastian Usher. On yesterday's Global News podcast, we heard from an Israeli lawyer who described horrific accounts of the brutal sexual violence carried out by Hamas and other Palestinian groups against Israeli women on October the 7th. She was also critical of UN Women, which took 8 weeks to condemn that element of the attacks. We've been trying since yesterday morning to get an interview with UN Women to respond to those criticisms, but so far without success. However, they did send us this statement, part of which we've voiced up.
UN Women unequivocally condemns the abhorrent attacks by Hamas against Israel on October 7th and has been closely following reports of brutal acts of gender-based violence against women in Israel since they first came to light. We recognise that UN procedures can appear to be slow-moving. This is particularly true for public statements on conflict-related sexual violence, which require thorough investigation by the Commission of Inquiry. This approach has been a standard practice in handling most past conflicts as well. We condemned the attacks on civilians in Israel in our first statement on October 13th. Later that month, the executive director decried the horrific attacks by Hamas and clearly condemned every act of violence against women and girls, including sexual violence, irrespective of nationality, identity, race, or religion of the victims, and called for the unconditional release of all hostages at the UN Security Council. We repeat our call for all accounts of gender-based violence to be duly investigated and prosecuted, with the rights of the victim at the core.
A statement from UN Women. Watches worth more than $63 million were reported stolen in London in 2022. That's according to a Freedom of Information request to the Metropolitan Police. The result has been shared exclusively with the BBC by the international database, the Watch Register. Some thefts involved violent ambushes by thieves on mopeds and gangs who specifically steal watches worth thousands of dollars, in one case more than $200,000. Tia Dondi has been making a BBC documentary tracking down the criminals who steal watches or snatch them from people on the streets. And she spoke to James Reynolds.
I wanted to kind of see why these gangs commit these violent crimes. And I also hoped by exposing how these thieves operate, it would help to spread awareness and people could be more wary when they're wearing watches on the street. These crimes are extremely violent. They're often wielding 13-inch machetes. In one case, I actually saw a gun. When interviewing these criminals, we do make sure that we challenge them. I kind of push them as to why they steal these watches and whether they have any remorse. This does affect the people that they commit these crimes on. Some of them have PTSD, they're scared to walk alone at night.
Do they have any remorse?
Often, actually, no. When I asked them, they said they didn't feel any remorse for their victim. Maybe it could have been a bit of a defence mechanism because these gangs are going out and committing these crimes so frequently. I think they try to put it into the back of the head what their victims are feeling or thinking in order to be able to commit these crimes. Central London is the hot spot. When I was spending time with these gangs, we went to areas such as Knightsbridge, Chelsea, Mayfair.
And these are very well-off parts
exactly,
of London, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. So affluent areas. And I actually went out with the gang leader, who we call M, and he took me out spotting one night and showed me how how frequent it is that people are walking around with these kind of watches. M said in particular that he wouldn't rob something that was less than £10,000. And these gangs do this full time, so they've actually learned which watch is which. They've learned how to spot a fake. They've learned how much money each watch is. Sometimes they have even female spotters that go into nightclubs and bars and they look out for their victims, and then they call up the gang and the gang comes and robs the watch off them. The gangs have a network of contacts and these watches get shifted onto them. Different jewellery stores, different pawnbrokers, sometimes even drug dealers, they say. And the watch register and the Metropolitan Police told me that often these watches make their way out of the country very quickly to places like Dubai. They have serial numbers on them, so they're very easily traceable. And so the quicker you can move the watch, the less chance you've got of getting caught. This crime is increasing. The thieves are using increasingly dangerous tactics in order to steal the watches.
Tia Dondi. It's a rare record for a football team to win all the matches they've played in one season, especially one that's only just been formed. But that's what a club in Turkmenistan called Arkadag FC has achieved. So what's the secret behind their success? Ruslan Tubatulin is the editor of Chronicles of Turkmenistan Online.
They have yet 4 games to play, so it might go even up to 24 games, which wouldn't surprise me at all, because it was named after Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov, ex-president of Turkmenistan, and also a father of a current president of Turkmenistan. So I guess that would be the secret power behind this winning streak. And a football fan contacted us and told us that, well, this is taking all the fun out of the sport, because it seems that the referee was actually helping Arkadag to win. So the football team with the name Arkadag apparently cannot lose in Turkmenistan.
And they're playing in a new city built specially that cost, what, $5 billion?
I'm pretty sure that costs a lot more than that. But yes, the new city is called Arkadag. The city was built in honor of a national leader, the Arkadag, Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov, who was personally approved the design of the city, design of all the houses, of all the roads, fences, and a lot more.
And he, of course, handed over power to his son, didn't he, in 2022. So who is running the country?
Yes, yeah, since 2022, Berdimuhamedov Jr. came to power, although I strongly believe that his father, Gurbanguly, actually still runs the country.
And Ruslan, how much support is there for this team, which sounds like it's all about the honour of those in charge?
I think every football fan in Turkmenistan understands that this team cannot lose, so it doesn't make it interesting to be a fan of the team. After this 20-winning streak, I would say, yeah, you pretty much are sure that they're going to win every match. Yeah, I would bet that they would win all 24.
Ruslan Tubatulin. And finally, for the last 20 years, the American actor Paul Giamatti has excelled at playing outsiders, losers and the hard to love. Think of his classic role as wine snob Miles in Sideways, who had a spectacular midlife crisis while visiting vineyards in California. That film was directed by Alexander Payne, and the two have teamed up again for The Holdovers, a film already creating Oscar buzz, which is about a boarding school teacher looking after pupils who have nowhere to go at Christmas. Paul Giamatti has been speaking to our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
You just earned yourself a detention, sir.
Being with you is already one big detention.
Son of a...
It's a classic American boarding school experience in the depths of winter, and these three people who have nowhere else to go during the Christmas holidays.
Paul Giamatti on playing history teacher Paul Hunnam in The Holdovers, a misanthrope under the mistletoe.
I can't fail this class.
Oh, don't sell yourself short, Mr. Coates. I truly believe that you can.
Set at the end of 1970, this is a Christmas film with a difference, and one very much expected to be in the mix during award season.
Do you think I want to be babysitting you? Oh, no, no, I was praying that your mother would pick up the phone, or your father would arrive in a helicopter or a flying saucer to take you...
My father's dead.
When it comes to the phrase character actor, Paul Giamatti could almost be the definition.
He has an issue with his eye. He has excessively sweaty palms, and he smells like fish. It's a real condition, apparently. And then he's also just an oddball.
This is something that you have visited throughout your career, this mm-hmm. idea of bringing humanity to people mm-hmm. who might not be that liked. Mm-hmm. What's going on?
I don't know. But for sure, I do end up playing a lot of these kinds of not terribly likable, unlikable people.
You know, he used to be a student, right?
Yeah, that's why he knows how to inflict maximum pain on us.
Paul Giamatti knows all about boarding schools, having attended one himself in Connecticut.
It's a little different being a day student. I didn't have the full-on boarding school experience.
I was interested to hear, though, that you actually filmed in a school mm-hmm. where you used to go mm-hmm. for swim meets.
Yeah, I had kind of forgotten I even went there until we got there one night to shoot, and I had this harrowing flashback going to a swim meet, being in this miserable cold bus with wet hair, and it all came flooding back to me.
This is the first time he's teamed up with director Alexander Payne since they had a huge hit almost 20 years ago with the midlife crisis wine movie Sideways.
If anybody orders Merlot, I'm leaving. I am not drinking any Merlot!
And the story that always gets said about Sideways, it did damage to Merlot sales.
Is that true? Apparently, yes. I mean, after the movie came out, Tom Church and I were asked to do ads for the Merlot Growers of America to try to rescue the sales. We didn't do it. But apparently only now has it been in recovery.
I don't think I've ever had a real family Christmas like this before.
And while The Holdovers is not actually released in the UK until January, Paul Giamatti believes it could become part of people's annual festive traditions.
Yes, I think it's precisely the kind of thing that people will watch at Christmas over and over again.
Give us a couple of examples of movies you are glad they're in that Christmas canon.
Well, I mean, It's a Wonderful Life is a great movie. There's a more obscure one that I like. It's a musical from the 70s called Scrooge with Albert Finney.
I hate people. I hate people.
I watch it all the time, but it's not as well known as it should be.
Yes, even with his taste in Christmas films, Paul Giamatti can't help himself.
And I don't care if they hate me.
Once again, drawn to an outsider that others might find difficult to love.
Colin Patterson and Paul Giamatti. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Hey, you. Yeah, talking to you. Welcome to Audible, where there's endless ways to ignite your imagination, like chase your thrills, slay your demons, even journey into the great unknown. And if you're lucky, discover someone, something new to love. Hear the latest audiobooks, podcasts, and originals at audible.ca.